cars, 3 kids, 6 phones. A whole lot of confusion up here in my home. 500 stations on the TV screen. 500 versions of the same old thing. Y'all know it's crazy, and it's driving me insane. Well, I don't wanna be a Superman. I just wanna go somewhere, use my hand to keep it simple. Oh, real simple. You know, I call my doctor on the telephone. The lines were open, but there was nobody home. Press 1, press 2, press pound, press 3. Why can't somebody just pick up the phone? Talk to me. Y'all know it's crazy. You know it's driving me insane. I don't want to be a Superman. I just want to go somewhere, use my hands and keep it simple.
isn't that a great guide for life? Just keep things simple. That's 3-time Grammy Award winner Keb Moe with Keep It Simple. It's from his 2004 album, and it was the title track of that album. Keb Moe is actually Kevin Moore, but his drummer, Quentin Denard, called him Keb Moe, and the name stuck. It's the name he uses now professionally to this day. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, August the 21st, 2015, and you know the drill. It is Free Your Mind Friday. It's the time that you have your say. You take the conversation where you want it to go. You share your profoundest thoughts and your most considered opinions with a very kind and receptive audience. 888-874-4888 is the number to call to get you started. And let's hear what you have to say about the issues of the day, or maybe you want to introduce something entirely different for our consideration and for further discussion and debate. 888-874-4888. Well, New York is starting us off, and Joel is from New York. Hello, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. How's your week been?
Pretty good. Thank you. Very good, as a matter of fact. How's yours?
Oh, excellent. I can't complain. Although when I look out into the world, I only shake my head. But, you know, that's not associated only with me, I think. I've been looking at Cornel West's new book, Black Prophetic Fire. You know about that?
I haven't read it.
It's come out in Kindle editions and hardcover. I don't think it's out in paper yet, but I've been looking through it, and it's I really recommend it to anybody who really wants to understand the basis of this tradition. And it's a tradition that stretches back, as you know, to Sojourner Truth and to Frederick Douglass, and has consistently named and damned the cruelty of imperialism and white supremacy. And West, I think, correctly sees it as the most astute critique of empire. That is to say, it expressed radical truths with a kind of clarity and a moral force that have eluded most other critics of American capitalism. And we see this in Obama's career as president, when he first displayed his fear of this tradition when he betrayed his pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who really comes out of this tradition. Obama, I think, has sustained the assault largely through black surrogates like Al Sharpton and Steve Harvey. And by the way, the Cornel West has not been immune from a lot of vicious attacks, verbal attacks. So I was thinking about all of this and reading some of the chapters on Ida Wells and Ella Baker and Malcolm X and Frederick Douglass, and it seemed to me that the tradition has been emptied out, that its leaders have either been incarcerated or murdered, and that a lot of political prisoners who represent the black prophetic tradition, look at Abu Jamal, are in jail, and they've been in there for decades. Or we have leaders, and you have certainly discussed them on this program, who are completely sold out, who have been co-opted. And so these, I think, are the major developments that are associated with this tradition. And when you have sold-out leaders, you get a pacified fellowship or people who are scared. Is it any wonder that some of the recent polls show that that Hillary Clinton is doing well in the black community, at least those who say they're going to vote? So it seems to me that the black prophetic tradition was almost like a leaven, you know, in the American democratic loaf. And it has kept American democracy from going fascist, at least up to now, or authoritarian, at least up to now, or autocratic, at least up to now. And that, to me, is the legacy of Douglass, of Tubman, of Sojourner, of King, of Fannie Lou Hamer. And it's not because black people have a monopoly on truth, goodness, or beauty. It's because the freedom movement puts pressure on the American empire in the name of integrity, decency, and honesty and virtue.
Well, I can't disagree with anything you've said, but I have a slightly different take on it, too. And that is about the role of black intellectuals who have intellectualized and commodified this information.
Yeah.
And it places them and the prophetic fire that they're talking about in a safe place. Most of the people that they talk about are safely dead, and everybody loves the people now that they're safely dead. It's great to talk about them having basically recognized that you can theorize and you can intellectualize them now that they're safely dead. So it becomes a kind of academic exercise, and a lot of this that we're seeing in academia is a kind of pseudo-psychological analysis of what was so patently clear at the time these people were alive.
Yeah.
I just want to finish this thought.
Sure, I'm sorry.
When you have, you're talking now about Malcolm X and people, you know, it's the role of black intellectuals, it seems to me, and I'm not saying that Cornel West is guilty of this, but I'm talking about generally in the world of academia. What they do is post facto analysis. And when the fight was at its peak, you don't find them taking these courageous stands. When Jeremiah Wright was so blatantly betrayed by and castigated and caused a groundswell of attack that was had one aim, which was to utterly and completely destroy Jeremiah Wright. And based on all kinds of contrived reasons, you know, he's preaching, you know, he's unpatriotic, he's anti this and he's anti that, none of that. If people understand the tradition of the black church, and this wasn't about prophetic fire, this was about the role, the standard role of the spiritual steward of the community. That was the standard role. All black preachers were so tied into this issue of justice and educating the people and doing that kind of political work in a spiritual realm. But that's what their role was. They were not being prophetic. They were doing their job. And we have now a tendency in the world of academia now to literally make of these things a kind of clinical study, and it's always post facto. When Jeremiah Wright needed righteous people, including people like Cornel West, who, of course, is in the church, to stand up,
and to defend him and to defend the so-called prophetic fire and the prophetic tradition, they were absent. They said nothing. But it is good now, they write books about Malcolm X and very intellectual books and whatnot. When the fight was at its peak, they were absent from the scene, or they made themselves scarce in one way or another. So I have a problem. I acknowledge it as my problem. I have a problem with this trend in the world of academia to intellectualize a struggle that was made plain as could be from day one. We were real clear, everybody, whether they were preachers or whether they were newspaper editors, whether they were teachers and educators, they were all clear about the struggle. And so I wish that we would have a kind of turnaround in this regard, that we stop the intellectualization of something that was made so patently clear. And these folks, by the way, made it clear in their own words. So they spoke for themselves already. They do not need to be reinterpreted. They were very clear about what they were saying. They were very clear about the problem. They were very clear in their critical analysis. If you read Malcolm X's speech, any speech by Malcolm X, any speech by Martin Luther King, they spoke for themselves. They do not need reinterpretation. What they needed at the time that they were speaking for themselves was a courageous group of people who would say, yes, we understand exactly what you're saying, and we agree, and we support your position.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying as I listen to you, but not completely. I have my problems with West as well when he really surprisingly in 2012 decided to assert the lesser evilism principle, if you might remember. But he quickly recognized his error. And it seems to me that that this book, among other things that he's been doing over the past few years, are really kinds of acts of redemption. I mean, he really has gone after the Obama administration tooth and nail, and they've gone after him. But that really wasn't my point. My point really wasn't about him.
Mm-hmm. I know.
And I wouldn't say that his book is really an academic treatise. It's not a monograph. He's really, I think, representative of what public intellectuals should be like. I mean, many, many years ago, I read a book when I was very, very young, after I had finished my work in SNCC and gone back to school. I read a book by Harold Cruz called The Crisis of the Black Intellectual. Do you know about that book?
Yes.
It's still very, very relevant, where he warns about the very things that you're saying. He warns about accommodationism, and that if you accommodate, then what is true for George W. Bush and Bill Clinton will be true for everyone. And so it seems to me that what this book does is it since it's not really monographic, is that it really is a very good introduction to people like Ida Wells or to Ella Baker, or even to Malcolm. And I think that one of the things that's happening now is that we need an elevation of the level of consciousness of all people, including black people, so that there's a structure out of which we can operate. And it has to be the structure of revolt and the structure of rebellion. That way, when you have young black leaders who are asked to come to a meeting with Barack Obama, as they were last summer with so many other people, they could see through the administration's transparency and begin to place the present crisis within the context of a tradition. That's all I was trying to say.
Oh, no, I took your point. I took your point very clearly, and I appreciate your point of view. I happen to agree with you. I'm saying, though, that you mentioned Ida B. Wells. You know, here I'm arguing that in the world of academia, we need people to advance ideas, not to reinterpret
them necessarily, well, but to advance
them. Well, you know, Therese, yeah. I agree with you in a way, because I remember reading Manning Marable's a book on Malcolm X, and it really enraged me. When he when he placed Marable within the tradition of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party in the end, I could see he was leading up to that all the time. And then I can't remember the author's name. It's a young African-American historian who wrote a biography of Kwame Ture, of Stokely, and I couldn't read that one either. So we're seeing an attempt to sanitize these people, and for whatever else that that West has done in his life, he doesn't sanitize them.
I'm hoping to get a copy of the book and read it.
Yeah,
soon.
I'd like for you to check it out and tell me what you think.
Yeah, I will do that. I've extended several invitations to Cornel West to join us, and we just have not even had a response, not even to say yes or no, just no
terrible.
Response. So we'll press on. But this is a trend, and it is across the board. And, you know, you talk about Ida B. Wells. Now, here's a woman, as a journalist, and at great peril to her life, pioneering work. She did the work already. It's there. She singled out this issue of lynching. She took on this question about the right for self-determination, including in the struggle for equal rights and freedom and so forth. Took on this question about whether black organizations should be led by blacks. That was the big fight, the huge fight she had within the NAACP, the National Urban League, and these people. She took on people like Du Bois. She took on the question of assimilationism. She was a pioneer, but it's there. She did the work. It troubles me that it is such easy work for an academician to do, to come and reinterpret a person who spoke for herself. Her writings are there. So there's no need, in my view, there's no need to reinterpret Ida B. Wells, except if you are advancing new ideas about Ida B. Wells. Because the things that are important to know about Ida B. Wells, she spoke for herself. She wrote for herself. And that's authentic, the best and most authoritative information that you can have. But a lot of academicians have taken the easy way out. They're writing, in the case of Skip Gates, for example, putting together these anthologies, and they're not advancing anything.
Now, you wouldn't put Cornell in Gates' school.
It's easy work. It's easy work. When you look at the scholars
he's a millionaire. Gates has become a millionaire through his writings, you know?
And you
find him, and he does these programs on PBS. What more needs to be said?
I'm
thinking of people like Glenn Ford, James Cone, the great theologian, Carl Dix, people like that, Robin Kelly, Margaret Kimberly, Nellie Bailey. That's the tradition, along with, Azuma Baraka, who's been on your program, Jeremiah, right? The thing about West, though, is that he has this public profile, and I think it's important that he's speaking out now and writing these kinds of books that are designed for the general public. And that is why he is relentlessly being attacked by Obama's black supporters, who see him as a race traitor, which is, the equivalent of a self-hating Jew to hardline supporters of Israel. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Good exchange here today. Thanks so much.
Okay.
You get us going.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You're on the air from Berkeley, Harvey.
Hello, wonderful Utrecht.
Hello, wonderful Harvey. What's up?
Well, today I'd like to talk about the generation of electricity without using water and introduce a form that most people don't even know about. And here in California, we have some of the western states, we're in serious drought. And I believe that in the future, that the generation of electricity should not have to use water to do that. And, of course, the old water-boiling technology, coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, are second only to agriculture in their daily use of our freshwater resources. But we have the technology now. We have photovoltaics, that means light to electricity, photovoltaic. We have Thermoelectric, that's spelled T-H-E-R-M-O-E-L-E, electric, thermo, E-L-E-C-T-R-I-C. That's heat to electricity, that's a straight conversion of heat to electricity. And then we have piezoelectricity, that's spelled P-I-E, like pie, P-I-E-Z-O, electric, E-L-E-C-T-R-I-C. And that's pressure to electricity. And now the one that most people know, never have heard about is triboelectricity. It's spelled T-R-I-B-O. I like the name, triboelectric. And what triboelectric is that when two different materials come on contact with friction, they create electricity. And for instance, when you walk on a rug with your shoes, you can, and you touch something that grounds you, you get a shock. And so that's triboelectricity. It's friction to electricity. And I think that one idea I have is that you can make shoes with a battery in the heel of the shoe, so that as you're walking around all day, creating fiction, creating triboelectricity, you can store it in the battery of the heel of the shoe, and then later when you get home, you can plug in and download that charge into your cell phone. And if you think collectively of all the cell phones that are charged up on the planet every day, and the amount of dirty fossil fuels that it takes to do that, then triboelectric charging of cell phones would be just a great way to go. And none of these three, once manufactured and installed, or once, you know, the photovoltaics, the thermoelectrics, the piezoelectric, and now the triboelectric, use no water in the generation of renewable energy. And so I feel that's the key to our future, especially as we approach more climate destabilization and more drought, is to move toward these technologies that we have and save our precious water resources.
Well, thank you, Hari. I want to ask you a question. Every call you make centers around, almost every call you make centers around the environment. When did you become so enmeshed in these things? How did that happen?
It started happening when I was walking around, and I started feeling that the sun was too strong on my face. It was starting to burn me a little bit, and I didn't know why. And I started finding out about the ozone layer and what caused it, the release of excessive amounts of greenhouse gases. And then the environmental problems happened. And actually, in the newspaper now, most of the things you read about or hear about are not really war. Of course, there's always little wars going on everywhere, but you know, you hear about environmental catastrophes, and they're just getting bigger and bigger. And I realize that this is a major problem. And unless we get past it, unless we get past our use of fossil fuels for one, that we're not going to have much of a planet. We're going to end up like Venus, where the surface temperature is 700 degrees, and lead flows like water. We need to move away from these things that are killing us and our planet, and that inspired me to start thinking of new ideas for solar energy, new ideas how to produce power without the use of water, that won't emit CO2, carbon dioxide, which is a major greenhouse gas component, and it's safe. Like it doesn't come with evacuation plans, nuclear plants. So I'm looking for safe, clean, easy, and especially as our power consumption gets more personal and smaller, we can actually generate enough electricity to power our own cell. I'm working on that. Like, you have to be responsible for your own power generation, and you can even do it, like I say, with shoes, walking around collecting static electricity from rugs. I mean, it's open to the imagination. And I think the most powerful thing that this nation has is its imagination, and so I'm trying to stimulate the nation's imagination into bringing us into a new, cleaner environment and a better life.
Thanks so much for your call today, and thanks for sharing information. You consistently do that, about what we can do to help the environment. 888-874-4888 is a number to call. Today it is Free Your Mind Friday. What is it that you have to share, to put in this pot, this wonderful simmering soup here? What is the flavor that you're going to add? We are anxious to know. 888-874-4888. Just to bring you up to snuff, remember we talked about that case yesterday in St. Louis, Missouri, where an 18-year-old young man, Mansour Ball Bey, was shot and killed after allegedly fleeing from a house where two white police officers were conducting a search. The initial report, as I said yesterday, that's the initial report as given by the police chief, Sam Dotson, was that Mansour Ball Bey, had pointed a gun at two police officers as he was fleeing from this house where they were serving or executing a search warrant, and they then cut him down, fired four shots. Today we are learning from the medical examiner that in fact he was killed with one bullet was shot in his back. The bullet entered his back and entered his heart and killed him. So he was killed. The shots from the police were from his back. So this all automatically raises the question about the difference in the accounts from the police, the official account, as opposed to the medical examiner's report. The medical examiner said that the bullet entered his back. The police are saying, and the police chief said yesterday, that the bullet, basically he was fired at when he turned to the officers and pointed a gun at them with the intention, one can assume, of shooting at them. So we have the same configuration repeating itself, as I said yesterday, and we at some point have to understand the context for these kinds of things. And it's not just procedural. It is not administrative. It is not about wearing body cameras and all the doodads that supposedly will change things. The thing that people should be concerned about is this ever-present flaw, this poison in our society, in which informs some people of their superiority and supremacy and their right to do whatever they wish to do because they will be protected. And on the flip side, we have people who are conditioned to accept that these things can and possibly may happen to them. And here we have yet another example of the what did they tell us? It's about the distrust. This is not about distrust. This is white supremacy, and it is pervasive throughout the police departments. As I said yesterday, the people coming into the police departments are coming from cultural backgrounds where these values are imbued at an early age. And simply because you wear a uniform or you go through so-called training, it will not erase that deeply embedded attitudes and opinions that people are raised with. And this is at the root of a lot of the shootings and killings that we're seeing by police of, I hate to use the word civilians, because it actually tells you that we have a kind of war. We have the military and we have the civilians. It actually is the case, but this is where we are. And this is why we have to become very real about where we are. We should not, you know, back away from it and duck the question. The question is, here we have a play out of the old formula. And we will be encouraged to think that there's so much progress, but you know, we just have to bridge the gap and we just have to encourage trust and things would be solved. No, this is a national crisis. This is a national problem that has existed for centuries. And the intention appears to be to continue the tradition, because no arm of government seems willing to say, look, if we mean to fix this, we just have to have a zero tolerance level of these kinds of practices. And we can't just shelter police, errant police officers. We can't make excuses for why things happen. We can't lie to the public anymore. We can't conspire among ourselves to deny justice. We can't hide this problem. We got to fix it. From Brooklyn, Sekou, you're on the air.
Oh, sis, how are you? How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
We're just hectic up in here, and but I just had a few questions and some observations, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. My question is this. Your first caller was going over the need to reinterpret, or he felt the reinterpretation of a number of things were very good and very relevant. If he calls back, what is to be done? That's the question. And two, among academicians and thinkers and pundits, I never hear anyone struggle with the question of organization, what type of organization, and how to consolidate organization. I hear all kind of platitudes about something needs to be done and speculation around culture and stuff and that, but I never hear anybody discuss in detail the question of organization, not reinterpreting Malcolm. And Malcolm is a forefront into a radical tradition, and we must remember that. But what type of organization?
All right, well, let's tackle the first question first, the first part of your question. Joel is the caller that you're referring to, and he was merely saying that this was a book worth reading. It was I who introduced the flip side of the coin with my own little pet peeve. And my pet peeve is about the world of academia basically not presenting us new information necessarily. And I'm not saying that it is not happening, that people aren't doing so. But generally, I sense, this is my own observation, I sense a kind of malaise and unwillingness of the academic world to just take on the issues and in the way that people like Ida B. Wells and Malcolm X and all the other folks that they now hold up before us, who, oddly enough, have spoken. They have been real clear about their positions. They wrote it down. They were not theorizing. They did that work already. So it's a kind of laziness in the world of academia to advance new thoughts. And there's a kind of a doldrum. There's a stagnation, an intellectual stagnation going on, where we are not seeing bold new ideas coming forth. We're not seeing the wrestling with huge problems. We're seeing a lot of make work stuff, make work books. And, you know, here, we know there, we revere Ida B. Wells, we revere Paul Robeson, we revere Malcolm X, we revere Kwame Ture and so forth. But they have already done their jobs. They have already spoken and they wrote it down. Just in case. We revere Marcus Garvey. He wrote things down. He was a publisher. For crying out loud. So I'm looking for new ideas.
Okay. Well, I'm looking for devil advocate, if I can. If anybody in academia would come out with new ideals to interpret, not reinterpret, to interpret the new phenomenon of technological overdevelopment married to the culture of social underdevelopment, that person would not be given tenure.
Well, that's a big thing you just laid on me here. I myself have to ask you to explain it.
Here, I have people who can call their mother, text a message at the same time, and get all kind of information from their phone, but cannot give me a complete sentence or a complete paragraph. And is born in a country, right, in this country, but still very inarticulate. around concepts or they're conceptually barren. Everything's immediate. And they understand everything of what they're trying to do in the most immediate sense, but not a long-range perspective or concepts like freedom, what is just, what is justice.
Well, these discussions, in my mind, are actually abundant. They're happening all the time, all over the place. It's just that, you know, they may take different shapes and different forms, but they are ongoing. What I am, I guess what I'm trying to say is that in our society, people have different roles. They take on different roles, okay? When we have people who are historians, that's the role they take on. Yeah. And the historians that we have had, I'm speaking now of African-American historians, they've done a job, a great job.
Mm-hmm.
They have, I mean, there hasn't been enough of them. But those that have done the work, you think of John Henrik Clark, Edward Scobie, Jan Carew, Ivan van Sertima, and on and on and on.
Gerald Horn. I hear on your program.
Gerald Horn, who, in my view, is one of the exceptional people who is doing serious work, real serious work, original research, original work. And, it, you know, every time I talk to Gerald and he's practically in a library somewhere in London or someplace in Texas or somewhere researching. He's constantly working.
Yes.
We do not have this. There's a paucity of this. And when you review, you know, black academia generally, you get a sense that they're just writing about what other people have already written and producing new books, but the books are reinterpretations of things already done. We need forward movement, and we need people to lead the way by doing that seminal work. As you raised Gerald Horn, I would point to the fact that on this program, it was Gerald Horn who pointed out the real reason behind the Revolutionary War.
Beat sugar in the Caribbean, and they did not want to bring that revolution or leaving that mode of production to the United States, so they had to defeat that.
Now, that is breakthrough information and breakthrough research and breakthrough writing. That's breakthrough stuff right there. And we're not seeing enough of that. We're getting a lot of people talking about what a lot of other people wrote already.
Yes.
To my mind, I think Kwame Ture is the best authority on Kwame Ture. I think Ida B. Wells is the best authority on Ida B. Wells. I think Marcus Garvey is the best authority on Marcus Garvey. So they have already done that work. What we need are the people like the Chancellor Williams, new people like committed to the kind of work like John Henrik Clark would do, and pioneer new paths, bring new insights, bring new information to us that advances our understanding of ourselves. That's what I mean. So, you know, when you go and you look at the bookshelves in these bookstores and you go, oh, another reinterpretation of a book is on the shelf. Oh, Lord, when is it going to stop? Can't we get somebody to just tell us something brand new, break new ground, break new barriers, take us where we need to go? We are in a kind of standstill, it seems to me, intellectually, a standstill.
What I think it is, I think a lot of forces, intellectual and activists, they celebrate the color of the broken clock but have no understanding or assessment of time. So it's always celebratory, right? And it goes no further than that. It's always like a racial feel-good, with my experience, and not the material conditions that we face.
Well, yes, because it is understandable. You don't have to agree with it, but you have to understand where this comes from, and that is in the academic world. You are relevant only as far as the last book you've published. It doesn't matter whether it is incisive or insightful. It's just that you have another book, and it justifies your PhD degree and
your tenure.
Exactly. It gives you a better shot at, you know, keeping your tenure or getting on a tenure track. So that game is being played. But generally, I am hoping across the board, we have seen not just black scholars, white scholars, Latino scholars, but in oppressed communities, they're the people who fulfill the role of telling the story. There's a general malaise, an unwillingness to go beyond the point of satisfying the status quo. And what? I'm hoping that we can see some bold new work being abundantly produced and taking people into an understanding of themselves that we're starving for. I mean, really. That's my pet peeve.
But I respect your diplomatic language of malaise. I think those forces have been defeated.
You said in diplomatic language.
Yeah, and I respect that. I really do. Right?
Yeah.
But those forces are only about themselves and their own intellectual individualism to pontificate, as if it's particularly deep. Right? And a number of the people, like I'm talking to Brother Cornell, and I'm talking to Brother Gates, if you will, and I say brother haphazardly, but they're about 2 miles wide and 2 inches deep. You see?
Well, Abby, aren't you being a little unfair here? A little bit?
I'm trying the best I can. Right? Because, like here, I've read a lot of Brother Skip's books, right? And I've read a lot of Brother Cornell's work. Right? Starting with Race Matters, right? And it was, to me, not particularly insightful, but, Cornell is a reverend, so I understand the moral interjection, but it was just a whole coalition of speculative and speculating questions, right?
Well,
but it was not a material analysis of what is going on in America from the first book. And to the left, because I felt like I was going to go see, when him and I spoke, I felt I was talking to a secular preacher who was preaching to me about morality, but not what was the contradictions of the U.S. outside of morality.
But, you know, you're looking, it is quite possible, and you have to take this into consideration, it is quite possible that your expectations, like mine, are quite high. And secondly, it is also up to the individual author, to decide the parameters of what it is they want to write. But ultimately, it is your choice whether to read it or not. And so I'm just hoping that we can see a revival of really good, solid academic, a whole group of academicians who are coming out with incredibly mind-boggling, cutting-edge work. And I'm hoping for that.
What is cutting-edge? And the standard of what should be our historiography, our interpretation of historical motion. Those things
well,
are
thank
standards.
You. Thank
and
you so
I
much.
See that lacking.
Thank you so much, Sekou, for your call today. I appreciate your contribution to this conversation very much. Thank you. From Chicago, it is Henry.
Hey, Utrice.
Hey, Henry. What's up?
Well, my apologies for not bringing anything new today, because I actually wanted to continue this conversation about black academia.
Okay.
I mean, it's a very interesting topic that that started with Joel and then the gentleman before me. And he made an excellent point before he left his call about how Cornel West kind of communicates to, you know, communicates to the public. And I remember something that, you know, Dr. John Henry Clark had said about the communication styles between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, because he felt that Martin actually communicated better to the common folk because, you know, Malcolm, in a lot of his speeches, didn't use a lot of big words, but his, you know, his words were very effective. And Martin was a very eloquent speaker. You know, he used a lot of, academic type of terms, but he felt that Martin was very, you know, more effective speaker in his speaking because he spoke to more common people. And I think one of the problems of academia today is that term of communication, because of the fact that they can't reach the common folk as effectively as, say, you know, some of the leaders of some of the grassroots organization people who are actually out on the streets, you know, talking to people and amongst, you know, the common people, in the communities. And,
well, let me just stop you for a second here, Henry, because I want to latch on to something you just said.
Uh-huh.
And you made the comparison about academicians basically setting up, you know, here is the Martin camp and here is the Malcolm X camp. And what we need to understand is that none of that matters. And this is a false construct, because now you have to fit yourself into a camp. Are you a Martin person? A Martin Luther King person? Are you a Malcolm X person? No, the two had valid ideas, incredible mm-hmm. ideas. And mm-hmm. The role of the academician is to say both were very valid. This is why I say for an oppressed group, which African Americans are, we have one of the widest arrays of intellectual power available to us. You don't like what Martin Luther King is saying, or you disagree, then check out Kwame Ture. You don't like that, then check out Ida B. Wells. You don't like her, then check out Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and Medgar Evers. We have a lot of that. But they mm-hmm. did the work and established things. They wrote, in many cases, the first draft of history.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote it. So you don't have to reinterpret it. It's there. They wrote it down.
But you know, Trace, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, I wasn't trying to go with pitting Martin against Malcolm, or I don't think when I heard John Henry Clark talk about it, he didn't, you know, say that one was better than the other. He just basically
right.
said Malcolm's communication was, you know, more effective than Martin. But at the same time, too, I feel like when you talked about interpretation, see, I learned about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King at a very young age. So, you know, at that young age, my influence was basically, you know, kind of like public school system or what my father told me about it. So it was sort of like, you know, I got the basic understanding of, you know, the difference between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King was one was violent, one was nonviolent. So the thing was that I'm like, okay. So I kept that, you know, up until, you know, like my college years. And then I started to read more about Martin Luther King and started to listen to some of the speeches that you don't see on mainstream media about Martin Luther King. And then you get this understanding like, oh, okay, so he basically was kind of in the same boat as Malcolm. And as we grew up, you know, learning about Malcolm, we understand how violent Malcolm X was and yada this and yada that. But it's like, Malcolm X has never incited any violence or riots, you know, ever. You know, he just preached about self-defense. So interpretation is very, very important. But the thing about it is that when you read about these interpretations, it's up to us, you know, and it's up to you as a person to do more research about them. So, you know, like you said, you can get a better understanding of what, you know, what message they were trying to convey, because I'm telling you, there'd be a lot of people in your ear, you know, especially at a young age, telling you how this person was and how that person was, unless, like you said, you go read their works yourself. You know, I never mm-hmm. fully understood Marcus Garvey until I read his book, the speeches, the speeches and writings of Marcus Garvey, which he wrote himself. Then I got a full understanding about who he was and why he did what he did, you know. So I always say, you know, it's a basic common understanding. Don't believe me. Go do the work yourself, you know. These books are supposed to, I guess, wake up, you know, the intellect of a person. And it's up to you to do your job to go research what these messages are and actually synthesize how you can apply these tactics to modern-day standards. Because, you know, one of the most misinterpreted books in history is the Bible, because of the fact that, you know, there's so many interpretations of it as in print in the beginning. And secondly, we don't understand that we don't try to get out of it, you know, the stuff that we can apply today, because, you know, a lot of the stuff was written in the first century and before. So, you know, we can't take it literally. We have to pull out what we can to apply it to modern day times. And I think with some of the black people that we revere, we have to kind of do the same, because it's like, you know, Marcus Garvey say something, I mean, the same context, but different tactics in regards to battling white supremacy. Yes, he battled white supremacy just like we're battling white supremacy now, but in a different manner. So we have to understand, you know, the times that he battled it and try to think of, you know, ways and tactics that he, you know, that he employed to apply it to today.
Well, I'm saying that when you look at all of these folks that you pointed to, they did the work of quantifying their ideas and their beliefs. They put it in writing. So, I mean, they did it. There's no need to reinterpret what it is they're saying, unless it is to pick up from where they left off and advance the thoughts a little bit further, even if you disagree. And you can do a critical analysis of Marcus Garvey, but at least, you know, let us understand that the man has spoken for himself in so many ways. The writing is there. He did the academic work and produced books, produced a newspaper. Ida B. Wells produced pamphlets and documentation of lynching in America. And we constantly have this thing in the academic world that as long as it's a new book, I don't care if it's a rehash of all these ideas they already made clear back in the 1900s, you know, early 1900s, or in some cases earlier than that. But hey, I have a new book. Oh, good. Good for you. Hope you feel really good about that. But at the same time, you know, we're not moving ahead in the business of advancing new ideas that are directly linked to advancing ourselves in a society and advancing society itself. Thanks so much, Henry. Good to hear from you today.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. I'm so sorry, Shelby, but you have a little bit of time left. But Shelby's from Louisiana, and we got to hear from you.
Sister Utrice, you asked about new ideas. You're not going to have people producing new ideas that challenge the power structure. They'll throw you out in a sec. In fact, Sister Utrice, they already have an unwritten rule or unwritten agenda that you're not going to challenge certain things. Certain topics are off limits. That's what it seemed like to me. You know, I don't remember too many people questioning whether there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody just went along with the program. It's just Utrice, are you there?
I am listening to you very intently.
And that's what I'm saying. So Sister Utrice, the book that I think is worthy of further discussion is Blueprint for Black Power. Because Dr. Amos Wilson lays out people's approach to not whether you like everybody or whether they like you. You can get past all that. Who gets the power? How do you get it? And if you don't get it, then you're going to be at the mercy of the people that grab the power. So I always like to look at things in a power analysis sort of perspective.
Now, because that book that you just mentioned, that book you just mentioned, Shelby, I happen to have something to do with that book.
Well, I'm pretty sure you do.
but you know, it's almost 1,000 pages.
Yes.
It's almost too much book in one place. But the thing is, everything that Dr. Amos Wilson discusses is advancing a brand new idea, a brand new way of understanding things. Incredible analysis, cutting edge analysis. And that book speaks for itself. It is an incredible book.
And he was the type of people that was a free thinker.
Correct.
He was able to just grab, and also he mentioned that if other people have libraries to deal with their problems, then black people and African people also need libraries. And people always like to think that we can solve our problems in one or two sentences or in a 20-page book. That's not the case. Our problems are as complex as any other problem, as other people's problems on the planet. And we need that sort of deep analysis that you implore right here on your program.
Thank you for that.
Yeah,
but I see this as a group project, Shelby. We all put something into the pot, and today we see the evidence of it. Joel got this whole thing started. He got the whole thing started today. And we build by communicating our ideas and thoughts with each other and exchanging information and opinions. And this is as vital a part of progress as anything else. It's incredibly important. So I want to thank you so much for calling in today and contributing to the discussion. Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope you freed your mind, or I hope the callers helped you free your mind. I enjoy talking and mostly listening. I really do enjoy listening to people's ideas. It's an education in itself, and you should value that. Learn to value the business of just having conversations with people who come to the process with an open mind, willing to give and willing to receive. And with that in mind, I encourage you to have a great weekend this weekend. Surround yourself with people who add positive dimension to your life. And we will hook up with each other on Monday. Until then, know that it is a great, great pleasure and an even greater privilege to me to be in your esteemed company. And thank you so much for keeping this high level of communication going. Bye-bye.
Well, I went down to the local coffee store. The menu went from the ceiling all the way down.